nothing is more expensive than bad information. Know the source. OneRadioNetwork.com.
Well, good morning. Welcome to part two of our show for July 29. It is the last Wednesday of the month, and that brings us to one of our faves, great guy, Richard Mayberry, who has been publishing the Early Warning Report, U.S. and Early Warning Report, for a long time, formerly Global Affairs Editor of Money World, very respected business and economic analyst fellow in the United States. He's had articles that appeared major publications around the world. His Uncle Eric series are a great series of books, and that are quite popular among the homeschoolers, and there seems to be getting more of those. He also has an ethics solution class course that you can take, we'll tell you about. So he talks about geopolitics, finance, economics, military affairs, and his newsletter is quite interesting. In the next, that's coming out just today, the August one, he's predicting, or he's recommending some stocks that are involved in a thing called RISE, which is Rugged Individualism, Supplies, and Equipment. I'll ask him about that. So lots to talk about. Mr. Richard Mayberry, good morning, sir.
Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for having me back. It's really good to be here. And let me congratulate you on being one of the very few people in the world that give an alternative view to the mainstream press. People are so misled, I think, by the mainstream press because of the press's very intimate relationship with the government. You're one of the mavericks who present a different viewpoint, and well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's our pleasure. It's an honor to have you here. We aired a debate between RFK Jr. and constitutional attorney Alan Dershowitz. It was on vaccines, because Dershowitz has been kind of promoting the idea of mandatory vax. So RFK Jr., it was pretty interesting. But the reason I bring it up to you, sir, because several times during the interview, Alan Dershowitz, constitutional attorney, Harvard Law, suggested that we were a democracy. And he suggested that if you had the majority of the people that wanted mandatory vaccines, then we should do it.
That's a breathless.
I mean, I'm telling you, seriously. I mean, Harvard Law, Richard Mayberry.
Absolutely. So if the majority gangs up on the minority, the majority has the right to force the minority to undergo medical procedures.
And that's what he was arguing.
And this guy got his Nazi credentials where?
Richard Mayberry said that, not me, folks. That's hilarious. I mean, how do you come out of Harvard Law and say something like that, Mr. Mayberry?
Well, it's actually a long story. I'll try to compress it quickly.
No, take your time.
Back in the 1800s, socialism was coming on strong, and the people that believed in it, most notably Engels and Marx and then a little later Lenin and all, they're often painted as evil people, but they really thought they had a new economic view that made sense and that would make the world a better place. But then their views were discovered and became used as tools by people who are power junkies. And power junkies all through history have been the kind of people who believe that they are so good and wise and noble that they know what's good for you. And if you don't knuckle under to their plans, they have the right to force it onto you. That's what political power is all about, is people who believe they are superior to the rest of us, they have better judgment than we do, and then they are allowed to force their plans onto us. And they hit on socialism as a really great way to justify doing that. And so you have now in the world, the socialist movement really gathered a lot of steam in the early 1900s. And it just has been roaring ever since. And by the end of the 20th century, it just essentially had taken over the whole world, including most especially the schools and the colleges. So it's very difficult to find a high school or a college anywhere in the world now that doesn't teach the kids to be socialists. And the really nefarious thing about it is that the better a student is in high school or college, the more likely they are to absorb this socialist slant to everything and to become leading socialists. So it's a horrible situation that has developed, and Dershowitz then would be an example of that. I'm sure the guy is very sincere in his beliefs,
Yeah. So in school, I mean, what do they teach the kids? I mean, how is that laid out? I mean, it's not like you get to go in the cities and burn the place down. I mean, they don't teach that.
Right. The kids, you know, the most important thing is that schools are socialist institutions themselves. They operate according to socialist principles. One of the main ones is central planning.
Central planning.
There are authorities who determine everything that happens, and the rest of us are just a bunch of robots that follow behind. And the schools operate that way. I can remember I was a school teacher for 4 years, a public school teacher. My wife was for 8 years. And I can remember when I first started out, I was teaching a high school class, and one of the girls came up to me and asked permission to go to the restroom.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think I was 28, so I was a young man, and here is this young woman asking me for permission to go to the restroom. And it just hit me. These kids are so brainwashed, they don't think they have a right to go to the restroom. They need somebody's permission for that. And that brainwashing that they get in the schools, that they don't have any rights at all, you know, that they are not really people. They are just things that need permission for some authority for practically everything. That arrangement itself is a very strong brainwashing process. And another thing that goes on is that the grading process, you know, a bunch of so-called experts decide whether you are an A person or a B person or a C person, like we're all a bunch of lumber or eggs, grade A, you know. It's insane. It is absolutely insane. But that's what the schools have become, these giant mass production assembly line organizations where thousands of kids are put in at age five, let's say, and they move along the assembly line until they leave the place at age 17 or 18. And they all follow in lockstep according to these organizational rules that are created by the central planners who don't even know their names. Now, people are making decisions for your life, you know, in some office building 1,000 miles away that are going to affect you for the rest of your life, and they don't even know your name,
So these folks kind of erupted, you say, in the 1800s and the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference between that and kind of classic communism? Same thing?
Classic communism? Yeah, communism is just the end stage of socialism.
The end stage.
What happened is back in the Cold War, I don't know who was really behind it, but they really warped the use of the language when it relates to socialism. The socialist theory was that human civilization goes through various stages. And you have, for instance, feudalism, and that warps into mercantilism, which warps into capitalism, which then warps into socialism, and then communism. Communism is the utopian end stage, according to socialists, in which there is no government and everybody just does the right thing because they have good feelings and they want to do the right thing. And there is no law, there is no direction. It's utopian. Communism was utopian. One of the things that they originally believed was when you arrive at this utopian stage, there would no longer be any war, and people would stop attacking each other and all of that. Well, you know, obviously it was nonsense, but it was during the Cold War that people started warping. I should back up a little bit and say what the socialists in, for instance, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, what a lot of the leaders would refer to themselves as is communists. And when they used that word, they meant that is the direction they want to head. They want that to be their goal, is communism. And so the stage leading up to communism was socialism, in which the government owns and controls everything and everybody, and that the socialists, once they had control of the whole earth, then they would go ahead and warp the whole thing into communism. So these leaders of the Soviet Union referred to themselves as communists in the sense that that was their goal. But the Western propagandists picked up on that and started using the word communism for the tyranny that they saw in the Soviet Union. And so ever since that warping of the language occurred, there's been great confusion about what the enemy really is. How do we know who the enemy really is?
But the democracy idea is very crucial. Of course, every president that we know of, I guess, since probably Andrew Jackson or John, it's talked about this as a democracy, and the old idea of mob rule or majority rules, and that just really at the nitty gritty of the Constitution, it just isn't that, is it?
Right.
We are a republic. Is correct?
That's not to say a republic is a wonderful thing. I've read a great deal of the literature of the American Revolution, and getting into the thoughts of the American founders as much as I could. And I have learned, actually, I went on a search one time looking for the word democracy in the literature of the American Revolution. And there isn't any. I never found the word democracy anywhere in the literature of the American Revolution. The early Americans were not fighting for democracy. They were fighting for liberty, which is a whole different thing. But again, you know, the intellectual elite in the country, which runs the schools, has warped the language and made democracy into a synonym for liberty, which is absolutely not. There's no American founder that believed in democracy.
So what we've seen now of WHO or CDC or, you know, these people doing their thing and mandating things with ostensibly no science, and we've done lots of shows on it. They're just kind of making stuff up. what would you classify that as? I mean, it's somebody that wants to, I mean, does it need a classification? Is it just is what it is and we have to figure out how to not allow us to hurt us?
I don't think I'm following you.
In other words, so you say WHO or a Fauci that gets up and he's the head of infectious disease, and the president puts him out there like he's, you know, God and knows everything, and then there's hundreds of people around the world that are saying that there's no science behind what he's mandating, masking and the testing is bad and shelter in place and everything. What's going on here? I mean, how does this even happen in a constitutional republic?
That's a good point. And it gets back to the socialist idea of central planning.
Central planning.
Where you have experts who know everything and who decide what is good for us and who have the privilege of forcing it onto us if we don't go voluntarily. all of these sorts of things, the CDC and WHO and the Education Department and the Interior Department and all of these government organizations are versions of socialism in which you have the government experts deciding how you're going to live your life. And they're the exact opposite to what America was supposed to be. And the early times, it's really fascinating to me how the American founders understood that the real issue underlying all of this is political power itself. What is political power, and how does it warp people's minds? And they wrote a lot about it. And the American colonists, not just the leaders, but there was that was an age of pamphleteering when people would write little articles and all, and they'd publish them themselves. So the typical pamphleteer wrote about what power was and how it hurts everybody and that it's a terrible thing and should be greatly reduced. And there wasn't much of it at that time compared to
because
now.
Because they understood it, Richard Mayberry. They understood the danger of this.
That's right, exactly. And we should be clear here ourselves what we're talking about. What political power is the legalized privilege of using brute force on persons who haven't harmed anyone.
Ooh, that doesn't sound good.
No, it isn't. And you know, nobody has ever told this when you're going through school. Even in if you're going to get a PhD in political science, you're probably not going to have anybody define for you what political power is. But the American founders and the whole population generally in America back in those days understood that political power is the legalized privilege of using brute force on persons who have not harmed anyone. That is the essence of government. That's what sets government apart from all other institutions. Only politicians and bureaucrats and other government employees have this privilege of using force on you even if you haven't harmed anyone. And the American founders and the rest of the population understood this is evil stuff. You can't have that power without being corrupted by it.
If you ran something like that up the flagpole to the Supreme Court, would they agree with you?
I doubt that very much.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court, today especially, but I think always has, but today especially, they see their job mostly as reading the Constitution and extracting whatever decisions they have to make from the words of the Constitution. Well, the founders never believed that they were creating a document that contained answers to all problems. But that's what the Supreme Court has become, is kind of a bunch of what would you call wizards who sit there with this holy document and they divine answers from this holy document. And that's due to a mistake that the founders made. And nobody admires the American founders more than I do. But they weren't saints or angels. They made mistakes. They were as human as you and me. And one of the mistakes they made is they put a line in the Constitution that says it would be the highest law of the land. And that meant that the traditional natural law or common law that was the highest law of the land in early America was supplanted by the Constitution.
Oh, so you say you feel they made a mistake by saying this is it. This is it, rather than have common law or God's law or however you like to say it.
Yes, right. A really good enlightening experience is to get familiar with Patrick Henry. Everybody knows his comment about "Give me liberty or give me death." But there was a whole lot more to Patrick Henry than that. And Patrick Henry read the Constitution that was proposed in those days, and he was absolutely against it because it contained that phrase. Henry was a lawyer.
Wow.
He was a common law lawyer. He understood what common law was all about, or natural law, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the essence of natural law is that your rights come to you from your creator,
yes,
not from the government. Hmm. Well, you know, he saw that line in the Constitution and realized, my gosh, this just completely replaces common law. And, you know, nobody corrected it, and it's still in there. And so today the Constitution is interpreted by the Supreme Court according to that phrase. It's the highest law of the land, and they're always trying to find answers in the Constitution that simply don't exist.
Interesting.
The answers used to exist in common law, but they've been pretty much erased by the fact that everybody assumes now that the root of all of our rights comes from the Constitution.
And we actually hear people say, well, I have my constitutional right, and it says right there in the constitutional that I get to buy a gun or say what I want to say. But you're arguing that these are God-given rights that were memorialized or enumerated,
yep,
in a piece of paper.
Absolutely right. Very well said. Very well said.
That would be the first time today I say something clever. So let's put that on tapes. Richard Mayberry is with us. It's the Early Warning Report, is his newsletter. And we're going to talk about some things that you might want to invest in. And it's so interesting. I really see comments all the time from people, and I'm sure you do over the years, that they kind of want to give you a hard time for investing in war and things that are, you know, other than the best. So we're going to bring that up too. So stay right there, sir.
Yeah.
And we're going to do a couple little commercials and be back if you care to join us. 888-663-6386. Email patrick@oneradionetwork.com. Here's a company that we have worked with for, if I can get the slide up. Well, there it is. It's called Sir Thrival. Oh, there it is. It's a great company. Daniel Vitalis runs the Sir Thrival. And we've known Daniel for about 12 years or so. And he has, you can see it right there, the pine pollen right there in the, oh, see it on the end if you're watching on video. If you're not watching on video, you don't get to see it. That's okay. But pine pollen is on sale, 20% off, 20% off. It's a really good one to get involved in. And I use this a lot, so I'm going to be buying some. It's going to go on for the next few weeks. It's a wonderful product that's made from pine trees and Myron glass. Very powerful to use as a food to increase your testosterone levels, but not like going into these places you hear on the radio and just get like little BBs in your butt and stuff like that they do, which is just like pure testosterone, which is made in a lab. And we don't think that's really the best. I mean, people feel better for a while, and then all of a sudden they don't feel so much. You know, say, you know, I don't feel as good like I used to. After about 3 weeks on the testosterone you get. But this is a food, so your body can use it more naturally. You may want to consider getting some. And also, often over the last 12 years, we've been working with Daniel, ladies going through menopause, perimenopause, and whatever in that age, and it varies, seem to do just a little bit better to getting just a hit there of testosterone. So we don't do medical advice, and I'm not predicting anything, but it's your body. You get to do what you want, but it might be something, gals, that you want to try and help you to feel better, because oftentimes, even when you go to the natural bioidentical people, they'll recommend some bioidentical testosterone for ladies going through perimenopause. So that's pretty cool, and it's on sale now on Sir Thrival. Any Sir Thrival link. Previously with Brandon Amalani of Shen Blossom, talking about our very special ginseng.
And you don't want something that's been corrupted coming into your body. Like the ginseng is a super important example of that. You know, when you're using aggressive alcohols and solvents, it has a strange effect with ginseng, in the sense that when you're not only over processing it, but putting it in really aggressive alcohols, what's going to happen is that you're going to flip the chemistry on some of the androgenic. Naturally, it's androgenic. It's going to basically protect the telomeres and add life to the body and protect the genetic replication of the cells. But it's also going to boost the androgens and boost the male hormones in the body. But if you incubate it in really aggressive alcohol, it flips those to become estrogenic. Now, estrogens, phytoestrogens, are not necessarily bad in balance, but you really don't want that with your ginseng, especially if you're getting like a really high quality, a really old root, something that's very special. You want to like treat it with care and make sure it's delivering what ginseng has to offer.
Just a short clip from Brandon talking about the way they do the ginseng, just to give you a better idea of where this company is coming from, the quality and the ethics. Brandon and the Shen Blossom link on OneRadioNetwork.com.
We are listener-supported, One Radio Network.
Richard Mayberry is with us, and he's here on the last Monday, or Wednesday, rather, of the month, last Wednesday of the month, Early Morning Report, his newsletter. You talked a lot about the longevity thing. I'm going to skip around in your latest newsletter, and you're really excited about some of the things going on, and I'd love to talk to you off the record sometime and share with you some of the things that we're learning about genetics and changing our genetics just by the way we think. You know, it's called epigenetics, which I'm sure you've heard about. And so there's a good chance, Richard Mayberry, that we can hang out for a long time here. And I don't think it's not a good idea to outlive your money. So that's why we talk to guys like you, because when you outlive your money, then what do, right? Oh, yeah. So let's talk a bit about gold and silver before we move on. I mean, it's quite interesting what's happening. Is this, could this be the big one where we're going to see gold just really boom, or will, like everything else, it'll do have some correction after these three or four really good days?
Oh, there'll be corrections. You know, I've never seen anything in my life that just goes straight up.
It just doesn't do it, huh?
Yeah, there's just nothing that does that. You know, I think the general trend now is strongly upward for all of the precious metals, not just gold and silver, but platinum and palladium, too. Actually, just any commodity, anything that can't be created on a printing press like money can, is likely to benefit from this. And that's what's been going on. I mean, as soon as the government started pumping out money for the COVID-19 panic, it became pretty obvious that this was going to happen to the precious metals, and it is happening. And they have pumped out so much money that I think it's a very high probability. There's nothing in economics that's a certainty, but it's a high probability that the demand for all commodities or natural resources or whatever you want to call them is going to continue rising, and I think probably silver will probably continue leading the pack as over the long term. There will be a lot of swings, and a lot of people will get scared and will get out of the metals, thinking that any given drop is the end of it. But the government has pumped out so many trillions of dollars.
Trillions.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's just you know, when people get afraid of the currency, they run to things that can't be created on a printing press, and the precious metals are out there in the lead ahead of anything else as a general rule.
And in your latest newsletter, in your August newsletter, you always do a velocity estimate, which is how quickly the money is moving, right? Mm-hmm. And that keeps inflation down for the moment, correct? If people aren't spending?
Yeah, right. Maybe a way to look at it that kind of explains what velocity is all about. Velocity is the speed at which money changes hands. And the more transactions a given dollar participates in a given day, the more effect it has on prices. The less transactions, the less effect it has on prices. So a way to think about it is somebody gives you a dollar, and instead of spending it, you take it out in your backyard and you bury it. And 20 years later, you go out and you dig it back up again and spend it. Well, during that 20 years, what effect was that dollar having on prices? None at all. It was not circulating. It was not participating in transactions. It had no effect on the economy while it was buried in your backyard. But when you take it out and you go out and spend it, now it's affecting prices, and it will change hands. It will go from, let's say you go buy a hamburger with it, and the person who accepts the money for the hamburger, then they go out and they buy gasoline with it, and it keeps changing hands and keeps affecting prices. And the more it does that, the more inflationary effect it has, the more it drives up prices. What happened, you know, 10 years or so ago is, you know, we got into a whole big financial crash situation, and the government pumped out some trillions of dollars then, but those trillions stayed mostly in the financial system. They never came out and started to affect prices on Main Street. So the question is, will the new money creation come out into Main Street and affect prices? And the government anticipated this at this time. You can tell by the fact that they're writing checks directly to individuals, and those individuals in the hopes that the individuals will go out and spend the money. And I think that what we're seeing happen with, for instance, commodity prices right now, is that all this money that the government has pumped out this time is now coming out into the economy and affecting prices and starting to drive them up.
Yeah.
And the financial markets are reacting to
and
that.
And it looks like there's going to be another COVID rescue. I think the Democrats want $3 trillion and the Republicans want $1. So say they end up at $2, that'll pile on another $2. And I suspect there's about $4 trillion out there. But if you look at the MZM money stock, we go to Fred St. Louis, we like that place, there's $21 trillion just kind of hanging out, what they call hot money, right? The money that could be spent, boom, like tomorrow. So people must be continue to be very frightened of some virus and what's going to happen in their financial future.
Yeah. What you're talking about here is the savings rate. Are they actually spending the money that the government's giving them, or are they saving it?
Doesn't look like, because the MZM's going up, isn't it, in the last few months?
Actually, I haven't looked at the chart. I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know, what is happening is that a huge amount of the money that the government is handing to people is being saved. The statistics show that right now Americans are saving money at the highest rate in known history.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well. So there are people who are scared, and when they get scared, they hang on to the money. They don't spend it. It doesn't affect prices. So, you know, I think probably something to look for is that when a vaccine comes out that actually works, you will see a wave of euphoria go through the investment markets, and everybody is going to be focused on the precious metals and the other commodities, and there is going to be a flight to these metals. Like maybe nothing we've ever seen before. And the rises in gold and silver, platinum and palladium here in the last week or so, I think are probably the early stages of that.
Uh-huh. So this could be a deep kind of a condition where more and more people are seeing the money printing and the borrowing and the debt. And so it could be a big move long term.
Yes.
But yep. As it'll take a while, though, right? Kind of, sort of?
You never know. If velocity was stable, then the answer to that would certainly be yes, because it just takes a long time for the money to circulate and spread out in the economy. But when you've got velocity being flaky like it is now, it used to be very stable. There was about 30 years after World War II where it was very stable. But it just becomes more and more flaky as time goes on, and it bounces all over the place. And if you have velocity suddenly go up, which it can do in a day's time. Back in 1979, when Carter froze the Iranian assets, it only took 2 or 3 days for a worldwide flight from paper money to occur. And all around the world, velocity just went wild over a space of a few days. That can happen at any time. If people get afraid of the currency, they will go out and spend it right now, and it will affect prices right now. So, if you're talking about inflation in relation to increasing the money supply, which is what people normally talk about, it takes a while to get the money out there and have people spend it. But if you're talking about velocity, where emotions are involved and they suddenly become afraid of the currency, it can happen within 48 hours, 72 hours. And this has actually been observed in a lot of places, like Venezuela and Zimbabwe and all, that there will be a rumor or something that goes off, and people will flee from the currency as fast as they possibly can. So that's a very common historic fact that occurs in inflations. So we're in that situation where it could be sudden like that. You just don't know. But when it is sudden like that, to see gold and silver double in terms of the currency is not an unusual thing. Mm-hmm. Now, within a few days.
There are forces, I suspect, are there not, Richard Mayberry, that do not like to see high gold prices because it's kind of the fear, the fear quotient thing. And so a lot of the big money guys and the bankers, they have ways to hold it down. Is that right?
The central banks, especially the government banks, central banks, they sit on huge amounts of especially gold. And they can sell the stuff anytime they want and drive the price down. And I think they do that. Gold has been valuable for like 6,000 years. And so it's the most trusted form of money and therefore the one governments are most afraid of. They're always scared of people dumping their currency and running to gold. So they'll attack gold before they'll attack any other precious metal. And I think that's probably what's going on now. You see silver running way up so fast, I think, because the people who are really intelligent about these things, who really know what they're talking about, realize the governments are going to keep attacking gold, but they don't care about silver very much, and so silver can run freely, and that's why it's running. And the other, platinum and palladium, too. They're very quickly becoming monetary metals. They're not there yet, but I think they're headed in that direction. But governments also, they're not afraid of them like they're afraid of gold. So they're not likely to be attacked the way gold is.
So, Richard Mayberry, do you think it makes sense for our listeners around the world hearing what you're saying, and there's so much being said out there now about gold, mostly gold, to get in some form of precious metal holding through whatever, numismatics, or just even a little bit and just hang on to it?
Yeah, I wouldn't go into the numismatics right away. That's a way to diversify. Mm-hmm. But the first thing you need is gold and silver. And once you've got some of that, you can diversify off and go to platinum, palladium, numismatics, other versions. And I think that's a good thing to do. The more diversification, the better. I really, really believe in diversification.
So you're talking, when you say gold and silver, that would be bullion coins from the mint or somewhere else. Even a silver coin from Mexico, they're pretty, those coins. Just 1 ounce silver, pure silver.
Yeah, for Americans, I favor the American Eagle versions of gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. The Canadian versions, too, are my second choice, the maple leaf versions of gold, silver, platinum, and palladium.
So when you go into a coin store and places like that, if folks don't really have a broker, do you pay a lot over what we would see on the spot price for like silver? Do you know?
You do now. Yeah, it used to be that there was only like a 2% difference between a bullion bar that you buy on a commodity exchange and coins. But that has gradually increased because there's so much demand for these metals that people are willing to pay whatever they have to get their hands on the coins. And so there's quite a premium on the coins these days. And that's been around for a few years, I believe, at least 1 year, maybe more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's likely to last unless, you know, some government, maybe the Canadian government, might just go wild creating new bullion coins, and then you'd have a larger supply of those, and the premium would drop back to the bullion price. They've always had, I don't know, about a premium of 2% or so over the bullion price. You can go back 30 years, 40 years, and find that.
Yeah. Richard Mayberry publishes the U.S. Early Warning Report, and you can go on earlywarningreport.com. So what is the main difference between the inflation and the big gold bull jump we saw in the 70s during Jimmy Carter, and it went up to 800, big percentage, right? Mm-hmm. What would be different, Richard Mayberry, now and then?
Well, now I think that someday we'll look back at now and we will regard it as one of the greatest opportunities in history for people who were ahead of the game, because there are so few people now that understand gold and silver.
Hmm.
You can go back to the 70s, and there were, you know, millions and millions of Americans who were old enough to remember using gold coins in daily transactions and silver coins. And so Americans had a much better understanding of what gold and silver were all about back then, that this has been money for thousands of years. It's more trusted than any paper currency ever. And the first place you want to go to when there's a monetary crisis is the precious metals. Well, millions of people understood that back in the 70s, but most of those people are dead now. So these new generations coming up know nothing about gold and silver, and I think there's a lag effect because of that. There aren't very many people in the markets trading in investments that understand gold and silver, and so they've been slow to pick up on the ramifications of the government's monetary policy in the face of COVID-19. And so the population in general still has to learn their lesson. So if you get in now, you're probably ahead of 99% of the population.
Really? Oh, even now? That's great. Richard Mayberry. So this is, I think, as a libertarian, you'll like this question. So I don't know if you saw, but there was a video out of a bunch of doctors on the courthouse steps, Supreme Court, talking about this drug that's been around about 20 years for, I think, malaria, hydrochloroquine, something like that.
Yep.
And they were saying that, you know, it's safe and, you know, you should use it. And they were just helping people with this virus, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And boy, it went viral, man. It just, you know, everywhere. And well, YouTube and Facebook and Twitter banned it. So now President Trump is out today saying, you know, this is not good, folks. So we got to do something here. So as a libertarian, I wonder, what do you think about these kinds of things? And we're going to see more of it, Richard Mayberry, in the future, right? I mean, should government be in there regulating a private company like YouTube or Facebook or like Google? I mean, they're all private companies, right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I really, really believe that the most intelligent decision-making mechanism humans ever discovered are markets. All the information about anything that you might be interested in is in the markets affecting prices, and the prices move up and down according to all the information that's coming in.
Mm-hmm.
There's just nothing that processes information as efficiently as markets do. And so this assumption that there are people in government who are smarter than the markets is absolutely nuts.
That's not going to happen, right?
Yeah. Among other things, you know, people will say, well, there are computers now, and
sure,
you know, they process all this information. Yeah, the computers are part of the markets. They're part of the mechanism for deciding what a price ought to be. So it's it's everything that humans know about anything is in the markets affecting prices. Now, my attitude on any of these sorts of things that are supposed to be or claimed to be cures for whatever,
mm-hmm,
is let the markets decide, you know.
Yeah.
If people are trying it and it's working, the word will spread and you'll see the price of the company rise. And if it's not working, then
nobody buys it.
Well, yeah, right. Yeah.
Is it? I mean, what's the term from a liberty guy like you? YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter, you know, for some reason they didn't want this hydroxychloroquine doctors out there saying that it worked. I don't know what their motives are, but I mean, so in a free market, they get to do that. And if we don't like Twitter, we just don't watch it.
Well,
is that what you're saying?
In a free market, there's almost no real free markets anymore. I advocate completely free markets, but they actually do not exist. And I think one thing that's going on with the situation you're describing with, mm-hmm, this drug, mm-hmm, is that the people who are publishing the information or helping to publish it or allowing it to be published are motivated mostly these days by fear. Everybody's scared to death that they're going to say something the government's not going to like, and you're going to have a bunch of bureaucrats coming after you and deluging you in red tape and bureaucracy and all kinds of regulations. And so there's a chilling effect on any information that comes out these days because of that fear factor. Everybody's afraid of the government, and everybody also knows the government is nuts. And that whatever it does to them isn't going to make much sense. It's just going to hurt them, and so it's, you know, very, very much moving into a Nazi Germany kind of mentality in this country and around the world. I mean, the people around the world have gotten that way. They're just scared to death that the bureaucracy is going to notice them and do something to them.
And so this is, you say, affecting both sides? Or, I mean, like, how does this play into what the doctors, I kind of lost you there, with the doctors and YouTube's responsibility or not to carry it, or Facebook's?
Well, I look at, let's say, Facebook as nothing more than an electronic version of a newspaper, mm-hmm, or a magazine or whatever. If somebody wants to advertise in some magazine, he can do that, and he's responsible for what's in the advertisement, but the magazine isn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They can't be expected to go out and investigate everybody who's buying ads. So when you buy a magazine, you know that the whatever ad you're looking at represents the company behind the ad. It does not represent the magazine. So all of these outfits that have these websites are in the same situation. They can't vet everybody who appears on their website. So,
and Google and YouTube, though, where does it put them? Are they just a bigger magazine? Or do they have the right, in your opinion, to block things? Or,
well, yeah, sure they do. It's their website. Just like my newsletter,
right,
is mine.
It's their thing.
Yeah, exactly. If I want to put something in my newsletter, I do, and if I don't, I don't. And I'm the one who decides, because I've got my capital invested in that newsletter.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that's just been the case with publishing ever since Gutenberg. That,
mm-hmm,
you know, you just because something appears someplace, that doesn't mean that the owner of the medium is responsible for what it says. And when these companies, let's say Facebook, starts to decide who's going to be on there and who isn't, or who's going to be spoken well of and who isn't, all
which
that.
They are doing. They are
doing. Okay. Yeah. What they are doing now, when they're setting a precedent where they are responsible for who's telling the truth and who isn't.
Right.
And boy, they are. I would bet a lot of money that down the road these people are going to regret their decision to do that.
Because you mean losing losing market share, or legally?
Legally. You know, if they are going to start investigating people and deciding who's telling the truth and who isn't, they're establishing a reputation for doing that, and then the customer who uses that particular website is going to be expecting that this stuff has been screened before he sees it. And if he gets hurt by it, then I think you're going to have lawsuits like crazy that'll come out of this. So they're setting precedents for themselves. They're going to hurt them very badly, in my opinion.
Richard Mayberry, Early Warning Report. Here's an email for you. What does Mr. Mayberry think about investing in vaccine companies or like oxychloroquine, even though I don't really believe in it, but does he think, do I have any moral obligation to only invest in things that I think are good for people? It was kind of a weird, the way they wrote that. I guess they're just kind of having, they're conflicted with investing in this hydrochloroquine company. I wish I could say that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, right.
But not being involved in the whole corona, event circus.
Yeah. I don't know how to answer the question.
Okay.
Do you have a ethical obligation to invest only in things that you think are good, I guess is the question.
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what you mean by invest in. I get this question in regards to defense stocks all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that you honestly believe that defense companies want war, and that they try to manipulate things to create wars so that they sell stuff. If you honestly believe that, then the question is, isn't it unethical for you personally to invest in these companies? And the answer is no. Actually, because when you invest in one of these companies, you're not actually investing in one of these companies. What goes on is that the company does an IPO, an initial public offering, and they sell stock and they get money for that, and then they invest that in doing whatever they do. But after that initial public offering, the people who have bought those stocks, then they sell them into the general market. It's called the secondary market. And that's what people talk about when they're talking about the stock market. When you buy a stock in the stock market, you are buying one of these issues of stock that is now no longer an initial public offering. It is just out there being traded by private individuals back and forth. It's a kind of money, like a Swiss franc or a British pound or a U.S. dollar. It's just trading, being traded by people, and it no longer benefits the company. So even if you think that company that issued the stock is doing something unethical, the stock itself that's being traded on the markets is just a piece of paper, a certificate, that is traded among individuals, and it has no benefit to the company anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're not subsidizing anything anymore. You're just trading a certificate for your dollars. So there's a very big difference between investing in an IPO and investing in the secondary market. And I just recommend, you know, there are these kinds of money called defense stocks that are likely to go up because of what's going on out there, and you might as well take advantage of it. I mean, when you do so, you are not promoting war. You're not doing anything. When you buy a stock in any company, whether it's a defense stock or not, or whether it's this pharmaceutical company or not, you all you get is the right to sell it and the right to collect the dividends and the right to vote in the company elections.
What kind of companies or genres of companies are you looking at with this corona thing and what's going on, and it could go on for a while, right, with sheltering in place and things like that? Do you see some opportunities to make a little money on the chaos?
Well, I'm convinced there are opportunities. I can't name you any. I haven't done the research on it because I'm so skeptical of the whole thing.
Yeah. You don't know how long it's going to last or anything, right?
Right. You don't know that. And I'm not entirely convinced that there even is such a thing as coronavirus.
I know. There's a lot of you people like you out there. I'm one of them, too. And not that that matters, but, you know, there's just no real evidence, Mr. Mayberry. We have not seen any evidence.
Exactly. That's my point, too.
We haven't seen any evidence.
I want to, you know, the news media keep publicizing these
numbers, new cases.
Yeah, these news releases that the government lets out that says there are, 100,000 confirmed cases. Well, I've looked into that confirmed, and I can't find anybody that's confirming it. they just say confirmed. Well, who is this person that's going around confirming these claims? There is, in the Department of Health and Human Services, there is a Office of the Inspector General for Medical Problems, and there was a woman, Christine something, I believe, Christine Grimm, I think, but I'm not sure about that. But anyhow, she was the Inspector General until a few weeks ago, and she wanted to launch an investigation into where is all this coronavirus money actually going. When a hospital takes somebody in and they claim that the person has COVID-19, they get money from the government. And if they put him on a ventilator, they get more money from the government. And if the person dies, they get even more money from the government. So who investigates to see if these hospitals, which are in dire financial trouble, who investigates to see that they're telling the truth on this paperwork? Because they're being paid to report that these people have COVID-19.
Yes, sir.
Well, this woman was going to look into that, and she got a huge amount of political flack, and then they fired her.
Really?
Yes.
Well, since this is so devastating to the economy worldwide, can you conjecture, just theorize, of what kind of forces are behind this and what would be a motivation to drive the economy, you know, sideways?
Mm-hmm. Well, we were talking about political power earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Political power corrupts the morals and the judgment. And what you find if you study the thinking of political people is they're always on the lookout for opportunities to acquire more power.
Hmm.
And they don't generally care what those opportunities are. Just anything that happens that they think they can turn into more power for mm-hmm. themselves, more ability to interfere in other people's lives, they will jump on that. And so I think that's just what coronavirus is all about. My guess is, yes, the disease is real, but it's no worse than the annual flu. But there was this bandwagon effect that occurred where all these governments started jumping on it, saying, wow, this is an excuse to get more power. Oh, boy. And it just went nuts from there. And, of course, the news media, they get more money for their ability to advertise if there's more people coming to them looking for news. And so it's to their advantage to find catastrophes all over the world all the time that people will tune in for, because they eventually get money for that, for the advertising.
So you feel it's more about power when the political, than money. It's more about power.
Absolutely. Wow. Absolutely. Yeah, you talk to, or you get to know people who have political power, and to them, money is pretty much meaningless. It's just a tool that they use to get more power. They enjoy the privilege of meddling in other people's lives.
Great. So that's what we're dealing with here. So we have to really be prudent to. So do you think it's important for those, like, there's a lot of people don't want to wear a mask or don't want to get vaccinated, to go ahead and stand up and say, show me the science? I mean, do you think this is important?
Yeah, I would like to see people doing that. Now, I'm not recommending that people not wear a mask.
I understand.
And all that. Yeah, you need to do what is best for you. And you know, my wife and I, we wear the masks and we do the physical distancing thing just as a precaution, because I could be wrong about all this.
There could be some evil thing out there. Who knows?
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, I'm not perfect. I make mistakes. I could be wrong about this. So we wear the mask and we take the precautions. But I think that the way this is shaking out, the longer it goes with nobody presenting any audited results of where all that money's going, the more convinced I become this is a big hoax.
Yeah, the money thing. And we did an open records request to the governor of Abbott of Texas and asked him to please show me the science, you know, behind your mandates for masking, social distancing, and the such. Mm-hmm. And they it took about a month, and they came back to their attorneys and said, no, we don't have any.
No,
seriously.
Kidding. I'll be darned.
We don't have any. We don't have any. I just said, show me the science, you know?
Yeah.
Show me
yeah.
the science. And I don't think there is, Richard Maber. I've never seen any, but so, oh, my goodness. Boy, interesting. You've been looking at this financial picture for how long now? What, 30 years for you?
Oh, let's see. I first started giving financial advice around 1971 or two.
71. So you were right there with the when the gold took the big move in the 70s,
yeah.
right? You were right
yes,
in
I
there.
Was. Yes, I was. I did very well from that.
Did you were smart enough to know gold was going to go?
Well, I was smart enough to suspect it.
You don't know anything, right?
Yeah, right. Until it's over with. But there's a brand of economics that's only taught in a very few colleges in the United States. It's called the Austrian School of Economics.
Mm-hmm.
The founders were from Austria, and probably the leading light is regarded as Friedrich Hayek. He died in 1974, I think, and he was one of the founders of the Austrian School. And the Austrian School is very free market, very oriented toward the system of liberty, and are the exact opposite of the government's Keynesian economics, which is, in my mind, all voodoo.
Voodoo.
And they were at that time saying, you know, buy gold and silver. In fact, some of the leading Austrian economists were saying, get all the gold and silver you can get your hands on. And I'll tell you, boy, anybody that took that advice is a really happy camper today. because if you look at the performance of gold and silver since then, it's been spectacular. There's almost nothing that's been that good, and probably will continue to. And the reason the Austrian economists were saying this is that the paper money system always eventually collapses. There's no case in history where paper money has not eventually collapsed, whereas you could accept a gold coin in ancient Rome and still buy stuff with it today.
Does Mr. Maber, here's an email for you from Jen. Do you recommend any gold or silver stocks or funds? Stocks or funds?
At the moment, I haven't been looking at them lately. Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes. If I got into it, I would be able to dig up maybe 10 that I would recommend. It's just that I've been writing about other things lately, and I haven't gotten into it. But yes, there certainly are several gold and silver stocks out there that I would recommend. It's just that I can't name them for you.
That's right. So what about the GLD or SLV, those exchange-traded funds in the metals? Are you are you comfortable with those?
If you're speculating, yeah, they're a good way. They're a nice, easy way to get in and out whenever you want to.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a long-term holder who wants to make sure that he's got some gold and silver in his hot little hand in case the dollar really tanks, then you should own the coins. And you know, first thing to do is buy coins, and then if you want to additionally speculate, then those are a good way to speculate.
One of the memes going out there in the financial world, you've probably heard, is called a global currency reset. Right? I'm sure you've seen it. Right? It's some idea that everything's going to kind of get all level. Sounds pretty socialist already. I'm just thinking to myself, all level playing field, and we're going to get rid of a lot of the debt. And do you have any ideas of what this whole, and there's a lot of people talking about this idea. We got to reset everything.
I can imagine them trying to do that, but I cannot imagine it working. Because it comes back to this idea that there are experts who know how the world ought to be organized, and there aren't. The world is way, way too complicated. So you just have to wait until whatever shakes out as the preferred currency does shake out as that. You don't know what the markets are going to pick. You got billions of people here participating in trades every day. And the idea that you're just going to come out with some new currency and it's going to solve everybody's problems is crazy.
So
there's no way to do that.
So what's our fave here? Article 1, Section 10? Let no state make gold or silver a currency, a payment of debt. So we were kind of thinking about it. In your opinion, Richard Mayberry, what if you did a blockchain dollar and divided the amount of ounces by the amount of dollars, and you came up with like 0.00086 ounces of gold for every dollar, something like that. Mm-hmm. Do you think that would be any value at all to the dollar?
For a short while, there would be people that would fall for it.
Would fall for it? Oh, you mean kind of like a Ponzi scheme, fall for it thing?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yep.
If you really want to solve the monetary problem, which governments don't, they do not want a solution.
Come on, they're here to help now, Richard Mayberry. Come on, now they're here to help.
they don't want to go broke and out of business. And the way they avoid that is by their privilege of being able to print money. If you and I had that privilege, we would never go broke. And it would be a wonderful thing, and we would enjoy it. We could do all sorts of things that we probably shouldn't do. So that's the way governments are. Governments are not, some kind of gods or superheroes or anything. They're as human as the rest of us. They're just ordinary human beings, and you give them special privileges, and they can't be trusted with it. they're just people like everybody else. So. You have to just let people trade with whatever money they want to trade with freely, and eventually, and probably pretty quickly these days, they will hit on something they trust more than anything else. That the main thing money is a store of value.
Store of value.
It cannot be money unless it's a store of value, and they will very quickly come to the conclusion that there's something out there that they trust as a store of value more than they trust anything else, and that will be the chief money in the world. And my guess is it would be gold.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Or Beanie Babies, which, you know, but I think let's go with gold for now.
Yeah.
But, you know, as you and I both know, and our audience is well-versed in the idea that government doesn't even print the money. You know, they borrow it from the banks who print mm-hmm. the money. I mean, that's like a double, like, shot in the arm, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yeah. What's up with that? But
well,
that's been going on for a long time, right?
Yeah, you know, the Federal Reserve in the United States was essentially the beginning of it. I'm stretching that a little bit. There was cases before that, but essentially, in a big way, the Federal Reserve was the big breakthrough for the government. And what that meant is they don't really have to print the stuff on a printing press if they don't want to. They can just let the banks create credit on their books, and then they can borrow that credit. So it's a big accounting scam, essentially. That's what the whole Federal Reserve is just a big accounting scam that enables the government to rack up all sorts of debts and not ever have to pay them off.
And we never will, right? There's about, what is it, 26, 27 trillion bonded debt, just bonded debt. And I think we're paying about $500 trillion close to that, just in interest a year, right out of the Treasury. Wow.
$500 trillion? That sounds awful high to me. I don't know.
You don't think it's that high? Okay, maybe it's not. Well, 26, 27 trillion, or what, 2%? What would that be? I don't know.
Well, you got the unfunded liabilities and all
that
you're talking about?
No, just the bonded debt.
Okay.
Yeah, just bonded debt is, what, 26 and a half, I think. So it could be close to that. That's what one of our guests said, but maybe you probably know better than anybody.
Well, I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but I mean, it's all these numbers are just quite literally astronomical. The only people that can really grasp them now are astronomers.
Yeah.
The government now, it's really clear that they are just printing money or creating money, however you want to say they're doing it. They're just pumping out bucks by the trillions and claiming that it doesn't matter, it won't hurt anything. They've just gone completely around the bend. And I think there's nothing else to be said about it, really. They're insane. They're quite literally out of touch with reality.
Who was it that said a trillion there? Pretty soon you start talking about real money.
Some politician a long time ago,
I wonder what Thomas Jefferson would be thinking today. Poor Tom.
Oh, man. You know, I often wonder that. If they could... Well, you know, Jefferson said that he wanted to see a revolution every 20 years because you have to keep slapping this thing down or it'll get too big and you won't be able to slap it down. And that prediction has been just so true, it's amazing. They didn't have a revolution every 20 years, and then by the time they finally got around to it, which was the Civil War, the federal government had gotten too big to slap down, and so they were not able to stop it, and it just has kept growing ever since. And now it's this thing that's just destroying civilization. And I'm not exaggerating in that. I honestly believe the federal government is destroying civilization.
Our federal government?
Yes.
Because of the dollar.
That's one of its most important tools.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
In doing it. Yeah, and I'm not saying they're doing it on purpose. I think almost all these people are well-meaning, but they are corrupted by their power. They have this privilege of being able to intervene in our lives whenever they want, and they use that privilege, and they aren't smart enough to do it well, and no human ever will be, because you're intervening in the lives of individuals you know nothing about, and those individuals are always changing from one minute to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just no way a government can intervene in an economy, which means in the lives of individual humans, They cannot do it wisely because they cannot ever keep up with the way those people are changing from day to one day to the next. That's what the Soviet Union found out, that they had all kinds of agencies for controlling everything under the sun, and specifying in great detail how things should be made and who they should be distributed to and all that. And all they did was just botch it all up and make progress practically impossible. And eventually it fell apart.
Is that similar to our education and Homeland Security and whatever, energy departments, all these departments?
Yeah. Yeah, these are all people who were taught in school that there are departments that understand things better than anybody else. Mm. That you should get a job with one of those departments so you can be one of these intellectual heroes who knows how the world should be organized. And boy, I mean, the Soviet Union really proved that that is crazy.
In the last few months, you've been writing quite a bit in your newsletter, Early Warning Report, about China with, 1.5 billion people and a government that's communist. So what kind of role do you think, and what should we keep our eye on as consumers of dollars and liberty?
Well, South China Sea is what I watch a lot.
No.
And also the East China Sea. The UN has claimed that there's such a thing as freedom of the seas, or should be, and that the U.S. government should use the lives of its military personnel to enforce freedom of the sea. And what that means is that the UN essentially has confiscated areas of the world that were once owned by various governments. China originally owned the South China Sea and the East China Sea and the Yellow Sea, and essentially the UN took it away from them and declared freedom of the seas there, and has asked the U.S. government to enforce that. And the U.S. government has agreed to risk the lives of American military personnel for this crusade that the U.N. is on. And I think that if we don't get somebody in the White House that's willing to say this is nuts, this is not worth the lives of Americans, then there's going to be a war in the South China Sea, China Sea, and Yellow Sea.
Mr. Trump doesn't seem like he's the one for that one. He seems a little hawkish.
Yes. Well, yeah. I think he's as hawkish as whoever he's talking to at the moment.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
Please don't anybody think that because I speak badly of Trump that I want a bunch of socialists in power. No, I do not.
Well, we only have two parties there, Mr. Mayberry. I don't know where we're going to go.
So. Yeah, you're right. I don't know either. But this man has no military experience, and I think his knowledge of the military is entirely gained from John Wayne movies.
Mm-hmm.
Now he is right about some things. I mean, back in the 80s, he was running advertisements in newspapers at his own expense, saying the U.S. should stop being the policeman of the world.
Really? I didn't know that. Yeah,
right. Yeah, he spent a lot of money on that, trying to get a movement started so that the U.S. would back out of NATO and all of these other alliances all around the world. And let those people, or tell those people, you're going to have to defend yourselves now. We're not going to pay for it anymore.
Mm-hmm. And he's been pretty true to that, really, hasn't he? That idea with NATO and the UN and the treaties and things like that.
And he's been better than any other president that I've known of. But he keeps backing away.
Yeah.
He was really moving fast on dropping out of NATO, and then he stopped.
Do you think he gets a call in the middle of the night, say, Donald, just go easy here?
Yeah, I don't know. I think He's a guy who his great talent is in being able to hire really, really good business people who are really good at running businesses. That's what he's good at. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he knows anything about anything else. And he has a lot of good intentions, but you know, those and a dollar will buy you a cup of coffee.
Well, not quite a cup of coffee these days.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Here's an email from Kevin. I just want to comment on Mr. Medbury and say that I've now listened to him on your show the last few times, and I really believe you give a grounded view on most things, and really appreciate Patrick having you on. We'll be purchasing some of your books on looking into getting your newsletter as well from Kevin. Well, isn't that nice?
Well, thank you, Kevin. I appreciate that very much.
So it's not only your wife who loves you. You know, it's great.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Well, Mr. Medbury, it's an honor to have you here. And you go to, Early Warning Report, if you'd like to get the newsletter, right? Early Warning Report.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, 10 times a year? 10 times?
Yes.
He takes 2 months off and he goes to somewhere where he doesn't tell anybody.
Yeah, right. I take 2 months off and I just go lay on a beach somewhere. That sounds like a great idea. I'll try it sometime.
please do. And then tell folks about the ethics solution, too. That's kind of a cool thing they can look at.
Okay. Well, I am convinced that the all of civilization is in a downhill slide.
Oh, good.
And the fundamental reason is that There are 17 words that are the foundation of ethics, and that humans have to follow those 17 words. They are: do all you have agreed to do, and that's the basis of contract law, and do not encroach on other persons or their property, and that's the basis of tort law and some criminal law. And you will find all civilizations throughout history have had legal systems based on those 17 words.
Wow.
Do all you have agreed to do and do not encroach on other persons or their property. And when your population loses its respect for those 17 words, the civilization collapses. And I think that's what the situation we're in today. Mm. And so we have started a ethics course where it only takes you 2 to 3 hours. I recommend it especially for teenagers.
Yes.
More than anybody else, teenagers need to read the handbook, and then you can take a online assessment and get a certificate that says that you have passed the course in ethics solutions. And what that booklet teaches you is how to exercise good ethical judgment. There's a system for doing that, and it's not taught anywhere anymore, except maybe a few religious schools. It isn't religious; it's entirely secular. But it's been totally erased from the school. It used to be taught very heavily in McGuffey's readers, but they were made illegal in the public schools back in the 60s.
Really?
Yeah. So there's just no teaching of real ethics that goes on in the public schools at all, which is. And that's around the world. So that's essentially, in my mind, the reason why we're in so much trouble is because both individuals in their daily lives and governments, corporations, all the rest, they have forgotten those 17 words.
Do all you have agreed to do and do not encroach on other persons or their property.
That's right.
I have a T-shirt like that.
Oh, do you really? Good.
I do.
Good.
And ethicssolutions.net. And that's a real conversation starter sometimes. You know, you'd be surprised. Ethicssolutions.net is the name of that website. And then earlywarningreport.com, right?
That's right.
What's your last question? What's your most popular book ever? What do you think?
It's called Whatever Happened to Penny Candy.
To Penny Candy. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
And it's actually a lot of what we talked about here today.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of gold and silver as money and what causes inflation, recessions, depressions. There's introduction to velocity in there, too. And it's written for anybody who's reasonably literate, who's over, let's say, age 12. Lately, especially as people realize that they're going to be educating their kids at home.
Yes, sir.
The sale of the book of my Uncle Eric books have just doubled. Actually,
I bet you they have a lot. Yeah. We're reading lots of articles. So, final question. I keep saying final. So, if the Supreme Court, as you say, are real constitutionalists, they just go by. Well, why haven't somebody been able to take the Article 1, Section 10, let no state make gold and silver payment, up for a spin and see what that would do in the courts?
Well, there were some.
Were they people tried?
Yeah, there were some attempts. And in fact, there was the Coinage Act. Congress actually passed the Coinage Act back in its 1700s. I mean, it was one of the, might have been the first law Congress ever passed.
Oh, the Coinage Act.
Yeah, and the Coinage Act says that if government officials inflate the currency, the penalty is death.
Really?
Yes.
Somebody should send that to Mr. Mnuchin and the boys. I had no idea. And that was right. Was that after the Constitution, after 1778, or?
Yeah, it was right after. I'm
going to look that one up.
Yeah. I'm 95% sure I'm right there. I would want to look it up before I put it in print. But I'm 95% sure it was the first law that Congress passed, and it says that the penalty for debasing the currency is death.
Wow. That's straight in your face, isn't it? Just woo.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to research that and talk about that next month on the last Wednesday of August. Well, Mr. Mayberry, have a very, very fun time out there. Are you still sheltering and everything there?
Yeah, we're doing fine.
People moving around.
Well, really good time with you, Patrick. I always enjoy this show very much.
So do I. I really do. Got a little common sense. Thank you, sir. See you soon.
Thank you, Patrick.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Richard Mayberry, OneRadioNetwork.com. Yeah, he's the real deal. Yeah, we love him. Get his newsletter. I think you'll love it. Really worth it. It's a very, very fair price to get it. And you'll get some ideas on different stocks. And he likes to look at the whole picture. So, you know. Okay, kids, we're going to take a day off tomorrow. We take Thursdays off. And see you Friday morning. No telling what trouble we'll get into our phones, and the phones work. And I love you all. Thanks. Appreciate your ongoing support. Let me know if I can help in any way. If you need something, just email me. I'm not far from my email, no matter what I'm doing. I'm always checking. Patrick@OneRadioNetwork.com. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. Look in there. I think you'll find some fun stuff. And take care. I'll see you Friday morning.
We are listener supported. One Radio Network.